why this mood, and can we understand what kind of mood this is, that he wants to be sick?
It's like there's some Shalagam Shilas who have a benediction that you get sick, but the attitude behind is like that the attraction to the Lord and my bhajan, I will still worship you even if I get disadvantage in this world, which is like not understandable for most souls, because they only think, I will worship if I get something. So maybe you can elaborate on the mood of the value of worship and bhajan, even at the cost of extreme disadvantage on a worldly, personal, financial, emotional level.
Also physical?
Physical, sure.
Don't be scared, sir. Don't be scared. Not only you, anyone, please. We have, okay, so yes, I know Indra Prabhu. I mean, I've never met him personally, but I've known about his life, and I've known some devotees, close servants of him, who live with him and did kirtan with him and so on.
Maybe a little louder.
Yes. So, I mentioned that, yes, I know Indra Prabhu. I had not personally, but about his life, and about I've known his some of his close servants and associates. I didn't know the detail that you are asking about, so interesting to know. And thank you to Krishna Chandra Prabhu to further expand on the idea, which is an interesting one. Of course, it can be misunderstood, misapplied, abused, or one can be dysfunctional in the name of...
So the transcendence.
Yeah. So the other day we spoke of some words about transcendence, being ideally not something negative oriented, not something about rejecting things or even asking negative things, but always concerned with the highest positive value. Paramartha, as we say. Now, in the context of that positive concern, there may be some, in some cases, some scenarios that will be more conducive for some devotees than for others. Also, this is an important point. It's not that every single devotee will conduct their worship or their bhajan in the same way, with the same mood. So there is place for variety. It's not just, okay, this is the only formula, and I don't know, if Indra Prabhu did like that, everyone should do like that, or something like that. Or beyond Indra Prabhu, anyone. One should put many things on the scale. Krishna in the Gita says, yukta hara viharasya yukta chistasya karmasu yukta swapna vibhavodasya yoga bhavati dukkaha. So for one to be able to destroy all afflictions through yoga, one should be balanced in everything one is doing, in his habits of sleeping, eating, even recreation, interestingly. Krishna is speaking about the yogis in that chapter. So yogis at those times are living in one cave over there, another cave over there. So there is place for recreation even in the life of such yogis. Of course, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur will comment and say, recreation for the yogis is to have a walk. Because they will be sitting maybe for 10 hours in a cave, so recreation is I'll walk for 20 minutes and return to the cave. So that we may need a little bit more of recreation apart from that. So every person again has to, not all sizes fit the same, not shoes fit the same size, if you will. And we spoke this day also about these days about not imitating, because we can imitate the great example of some personality, but without having the same inner inspiration, vision, motivation that person. So what's healthy for someone is dysfunctional for others. That can happen, especially in the name of transcendence, when we have these superhero-like examples that sometimes are like too much. So we can inspire. You study the life of, as we were saying today, Haridas Thakur, Raghunath Das Goswami, anyone for that matter of our great acharyas, and you feel inspired. But if you try to reproduce that in your own life story, you may realize, hopefully after a few minutes, that it's not for you yet. But still, you should be inspired by that. Still, you shouldn't go to the extreme of, oh, that's not for me, that's too high, so relax. No, relax, but not the other extreme either. No, I like to say there are two extremes. You have the extreme of neurosis and complacency. No? Something like that. No? So complacency, you follow the idea of complacency? To be complacent, to be... For sure you have a very specific German word for that. More than in English. And the other extreme is neurosis. Or you're just going crazy trying to do everything perfectly and following what someone else is doing, but it's way beyond your reach. So those are the two extremes, neurosis and complacency. So we'll have to find a middle point to make our practice sustainable. Because, again, we want to practice bhakti not for today, not for the next week, not as a hobby for a few years. But as we saw these days, bhakti is both sadhana and sadhya. So what we are doing now, we want to do it in eternity. So how can I do something for eternity? It has to be sustainable. If it's not sustainable for me in this life, in a few years, how will it be sustainable forever in eternity? So that's an art. No, that's an art. Some days we will have to know when to push forward, and some days we have to know when to push back and wait for a minute, and then continue progressing. No. It's like a journey, no? It's like a journey when we come here. We came here some days ago to Ananda Dham. At least that was for me, not for Mom. Wait. Krishna Chandra Prabhu, wait for one minute.
Well, he's flying,
eh? Yeah. Well, so I need some rest, please. Wait. So there's ups and downs, lefts and rights. At some moment you are going quicker, at some moment you have to go slower, you have to take care, you may fall, and so many things. You may need help. So I was thinking, this is just our own journey as sadhakas. No? We are on a journey here. Even if you are in the same, if you make a vow to never leave the mountain, still you are on a journey. You are traveling internally so much. So the journey has to be sustainable. And so many things will happen in a journey, unexpected things. So, I'm kind of introducing the point of the question and gradually building up there. I remember once someone told my Guru Maharaj, because as I told you the other day, my Guru Maharaj was originally a member of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, founded by Srila Prabhupada. And at some point, he was made to choose between staying there or leaving the institution. Because he had some inspiration with Srila Siddhar Maharaj, since Srila Prabhupada told him to go to him. But unfortunately, at that time, officially in the mission, you were not allowed to hear from Srila Siddhar Maharaj. So my Guru Maharaj was made to choose. You can stay here and stop listening to Srila Sridhar Maharaj, or you can continue to listen to him, but you have to leave the mission. So, for my Guru Maharaj, there was not too much to think about. Tell me when I have to sign or to resign. He went at the feet of Srila Sridhar Maharaj. So, after some time, some devotees came to him and told him, Tripurari Maharaj, why don't you return to ISKCON, to the mission that he was originally? And the reason was, if you return there, you will have too many opportunities to develop tolerance. Interesting proposal. No? So he was told that you don't imagine how many opportunities to be more tolerant you will have if you return. But my Guru Maharaj said, I mean, I already had to tolerate things. No? So it's not about trying to look for the situation in which I have to tolerate the most possible things. It's about try to create the most favorable environment for your practice. And in that context, you will have to tolerate things nonetheless. You follow? So that's...
Otherwise it would have a touch of spiritual masochism.
That's the idea, yeah. It's not as a form of masochism. Mm. Suffering for its own sake or something like this. Oh, my Guru Maharaj always likes to mention this Radha Madan Mohan temple in Vrindavan that Srila Sanatana Goswami Prabhu established. I don't know, I imagine some of you had the chance of being there. So that's a very beautiful spot in Vrindavan, no? High on a hill, you have such a sight. You can imagine what was Vrindavan 500 years ago and how he could be in such a beautiful spot and contemplate Jamuna and all different places. So the point of my Guru Maharaj is Sanatana Goswami picked a nice spot for his bhajan. He didn't think, let me find the ugliest place in Vrindavan so I have to tolerate a lot of this. No. He said, I will look a very nice place, peaceful, beautiful. And in that context, I will have to tolerate for sure many things. And he had.
We even also have to tolerate here some things, even if it's a nice place.
I imagine. I know. One thing is to visit the place for a week and it seems like, oh, you don't have to tolerate anything here. But when you stay a few days in any place, you realize, I mean, no matter it's in the mountain, in the city, in Switzerland, South America, you have to tolerate some things. Even happiness. Krishna says in the Gita, Matra sparsas tu kaunteya sitoshna sukha dukha da agama panyo nitya stamstitik shashabharata. Krishna says to Arjuna, basically, try to tolerate happiness and distress. Which is like, what? I thought I had to tolerate only distress and just run after happiness. Of course, he's speaking about material happiness, which is the counterpart of material distress. And one will turn into the other quickly, and vice versa. So he's saying, when you are too happy materially, do not become too happy. Tolerate. When you become too distressed materially, do not become too distressed. Because you will become happy soon. But you don't become too happy because you will be distressed again soon. So the idea is try to be equipoised. Sama. Try to attain tranquility, balance, not being carried by these waves of duality. So, my point is again, as devotees, we already have to tolerate things. So, it's not a sin, it's not bad to try to settle a nice atmosphere and environment for your bhajan. No? It's not like all of you here in the mountain are sense enjoyers because you are not going through the tapasya of living in the city. Go to the city and make a real sacrifice. What do you think, Damayanti? Do you agree? It's not like that. No? It's not like that. So you try to find the best possible situation, and in that context, you will have to tolerate. Even in Ananda Dham. There is Ananda, but there is something to tolerate for sure. And that's not bad. You mean, it's not like, oh, you have also to tolerate, then it's not so nice as I thought. No, no, it's nice. If you have to tolerate things, it doesn't mean it's not so nice. There's a nice side to tolerate, to tolerance. We spoke these days about that. Tateinu kampamsu, so many verses when tolerance can be turned into an opportunity to increase my prayer, to increase my dedication, to give further, like a tree, as we say today. Tarori vasagishnu. So that on one side. So that said, obstacles can become udipana. Today I was studying one section of Priti Sandarbha, and Jiva Goswami is quoting, speaking about udipana vibhav, which means stimulants in that will kindle your bhakti. So he's speaking of different types of stimulants. For example, he's speaking about Krishna and his flute, of course, this most obvious, if you will, udipana, Krishna's flute and Krishna's beauty and this and that. But then he starts to go to obstacles. No? Those can be also, can stimulate your practice. Today Krishna Chandrabhu was showing me a very secret, confidential spot here in Ananda Dham. Maybe not all of you know it. I don't know. So then you have to go and ask for him, show me that spot. There's a spot when there's one line in Sanskrit, but it's hidden. He knows. Which is connected to what we spoke some days ago. Mahaprabhu advising the Goswamis in Parakiya terms. Right? So you act at home in some way as to not create any suspicion, but in your inner world, something else is going on. So, love, we are getting gradually there, yeah. So love needs to be, love is something secret in itself. Krishna says in the Gita, Raja Vidya, Raja Guhyam, Idam Paramam Guhyam, also in the Bhagavatam. This is the greatest secret. Love is the greatest secret. What to speak if the love is an unrequited love, as we said the other day. I don't know how to say in German that. Yeah, paramour love. No? Love is secret. What to speak about secret love in itself? No, clandestine, underground, like the one Sri Radha feels for Krishna. So the point is, Sri Radha, for example, in her Parakiya, she has to go through many obstacles on a daily basis. She begins to begin with, she lives in a dysfunctional family. Jatila, Kutila, Abhimanyu. One is more dysfunctional than the other. Constantly, you know these words. Jatila comes from Jata. Jata means like dreadlocks, like when the hair is like entangled. So it's entangled, this type of mentality she has, like a dreadlock mind. And kutila means crooked. Hari bhagati premna swabhava kutila bhavet. Crooked. So that speaks of the mind of kutila and jatila. Their names speak for themselves, basically. And abhimanyu also is connected with abhiman. Always thinking about how to increase his own herds and having more cows and money and self-centeredness. Of course, they are part of the lila, So they're not bad people, just to get a point.
Otherwise it becomes boring.
That's the point we are going. So we need, Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, opposition increases the harmony. Opposition increases the opportunity for harmony. You follow? If you receive opposition in your life, in order for that not to be opposition anymore, you have to harmonize that to the point that it's no longer opposition. You have to integrate the complexity. So opposition is creating, is a blessing. So this way, Jatila, Kurtila, Abhimanyu, all these obstacles are actually anudipana, and a stimulant for Radha's Parakya. If you don't have Jatila, Kurtila, you don't have Parakya, basically. Because Parakya implies the risk of this forbidden love, if you will. And in the context of that, all the obstacles that have to be crossed for that to happen. That's a special glory of Parakya Bhava. So it's not that Radha is praying for obstacles in this case, but she's not rejecting them, basically. She's taking full advantage of them, nourishing her own affinity, attraction, love, making obstacles to increase their love. Now, you have so many stories of that of our acharyas, of our own Goswamis. No? For example, Sanatana Goswami was dying to join Mahaprabhu. He really, Lolyam, he had Lolyam to join Mahaprabhu, to live with him. And what happened? He was put in jail. Try to imagine. You want to just run after Mahaprabhu and you're put in jail. Raghunath Das Goswami wanted so badly to join Mahaprabhu, he was kept in the shackles of home, of his household life, that he was wanted to transcend. He was not attached to, but he was taken. He escaped home, he was brought back. He escaped home, he was brought back. Over and over again. Gopal Bhatta Goswami met Mahaprabhu in South India as a child, and he would just want to join Mahaprabhu as a child. No? In South India. And Mahaprabhu himself told him, no. Not now. Take care of your parents, and then we will meet. So in this way, all these Goswamis had these similar dynamics. And you can say, but they wanted to join Mahaprabhu. Of course, they received his mercy eventually, but these obstacles were coming. But the result of the obstacle was their longing increased. They didn't get discouraged and say, oh, let's do something else with our lives. It's not working. No, no, no. The obstacle created in them an increasing of their longing so they could overcome the obstacle. There are many stories like this. Srinivas Acharya studying Bhagavatam from that other pandit. Lokanath Goswami wanted to meet Mahaprabhu. I mean, there are unending stories of these same dynamics. Wanting something is not happening. Go another place, it's not happening. Go another place, it's not happening. But all of this is increasing their longing more and more and more and more and more. So in one sense, it's not that we are, again, masochists, that we are purposely looking for obstacles, but we are not against obstacles when they come out of their own accord. Because even if we may try ourselves to force those obstacles to come, there may be more our own creation and not the divine dispensation. But when I'm not looking for an obstacle and the obstacle came, then that for sure has come from above. That's the idea. I was not trying to create that, but that came. So there must be some purpose to that. So that's another way of approaching that. But also when Moses was making the question and Krishna Chandra was clarifying also, another verse came to my mind from Kunti Devi. Today we share one in the morning. And there's another one, maybe even more famous. Yes. Vipada santata sasvat tratatra jagat guru how is this in Finland? Bhavatu darshanam apunar bhava darshanam. Yeah. Yes. So that's an interesting prayer by Kunti. She's basically asking Krishna, I mean, and to fully appreciate the meaning of this verse, you have to know Kunti Devi's life story. Huh? Her life story is one obstacle after another. And when that's over, another obstacle is coming. And every time the obstacles are more intense. And what is she praying for in this verse? Krishna, please send me obstacles. Send me more problems. So is she a masochist? No. She's saying, the more obstacles you send me, the more I'm having your darshan. Every time there has been problems in my life, I've taken shelter in you, and you have shown yourself. So actually, these obstacles or problems are just like portals to your darshan. So in this way, she was praying with that type of insight, vision. Because as we said the other day, when something comes to our life and we feel this is an obstacle, and the question is, what's an obstacle? What's a problem? What's suffering? For some people, one thing, for some other people, another thing. So, the point is, if something makes us feel suffering or this is an obstacle, we could just say this is an invitation to transcend my own perception of what I think is an obstacle. Why do I feel something is an obstacle? We should ask ourselves that question. When I feel one obstacle came to my life, Maharaj, I have a problem. Krishna Chandra Prabhu, I'm suffering. But that's not the end of the conversation. That's just we are just grasping the surface of the whole thing. Suffering, all the things, is a symptom of what's actually going on behind the symptom. Why you're suffering? No. Probably, again, I'm speaking in general, but sometimes we're suffering just because we are attached. And the suffering is just pointing to my attachment. So I can acknowledge that, work on that, and stop suffering. So that initial suffering took me to not more suffering. I'm giving a general example, of course. No? There are so many circumstances.
Maybe because I don't see a solution for the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe because I'm not willing to know the solution. Because generally, the solution to a challenge is to do something that I have not done till today. Sometimes we are not willing to embrace the necessary effort or sacrifice to change. So we prefer not to know what's actually going on, what's actually taking place. And many times we just play the victim. Victim consciousness. That's the opposite of Krishna consciousness. So be careful that being practicing Krishna consciousness and playing victim consciousness. It can happen. Why Krishna is doing this to me? Why he's so cruel? He doesn't know what I need. He doesn't hear my prayers. He's not replying for what I ask him, and all these type of things. So the point is, again, some devotees may be willing to conduct themselves in, to conduct certain worship that they know it may include some certain challenges, like the example Moses gave. And again, that should be done in a sustainable way. But it's a way of accepting, I know I'm entering in outside of my comfort zone in this situation. And I'm willingly choosing to do so. I'm taking responsibility for my choice. I know that by doing this, I will be challenged. And I accept the challenge. Because I need challenges. Not extreme challenges. Because if something comes and it's impossible to... A test comes and it's impossible to pass, I get discouraged. But if no tests are coming, it's boring. So again, you have two extremes. Easy and impossible. So what's the middle point between easy and impossible? Difficult. Difficult is not extreme. Difficult is middle point. Extreme is easy and impossible. But sometimes when something difficult comes, oh no. So extreme, I can't... before even trying.
What do you imply by it's impossible? Yeah. You say the extreme is impossible. What do you imply by impossible? When the challenge is there, it's there, right?
Yeah, of course. But my point is, of course, whatever comes to our life, if it's coming, it's because it's possible to pass the test. But sometimes we play the impossible. And we say, it's not possible, it's too much. But for some reason it's coming. And for some reason something else is not coming, which will be impossible for me at this present moment. But it's not coming yet. Like again, if you hear, I don't know, gave the example the other day, Jesus Christ being crucified. For us it may be impossible, and that's why nobody's crucifying us now. Because it will be impossible to pass the test. But something else may be coming to us, and we may subjectively feel that we are being crucified. Without any cross, without any nails, but... something inside of us feels it. So, but that's the crucifixion according to our present capacity that is coming to visit us. So in that sense, we shouldn't say, oh, that's impossible. No, if this comes into your life, Krishna will never send you a test that you cannot pass. But some tests will be impossible to pass if you don't take shelter in Krishna. So that's part of the test. I mean, Krishna says in the Gita, Daibi yesha gunamai mama maya duratyaya. Amiva ye prapadyanti maya mitataranatita. This material energy, Krishna is saying, is almost impossible to transcend. Try to imagine Krishna saying that. It's very difficult. That's the half of the verse. So all of us may get discouraged there. Oof. If Krishna says very difficult, I say impossible for me. But then Krishna says, but if you surrender to me, that thing which is almost impossible becomes
easy.
Not even possible. Easy. So what makes the difference between impossible and easy is Krishna in between. And again, the in-between between impossible and easy is difficult. So if difficult is in between, Krishna is in between, bringing difficulty to your life. And that's what Kunti Devi is praying for here. Bring me difficulties. And she equates, bring me difficulties, come to my life yourself. Krishna equal difficulty. She's making that equation. Oh. But again, she's not masochist. Try to get this point. She just understands. I need to be put to test.
Christmas time, I don't know which Acharya was saying this, when obstacles and problems arrive, it's like Christmas time, Christmas tree, we should celebrate, be happy, you know, with all these opportunities as gifts.
I know it's easy to say, of course, no? It's maybe difficult in practice to just, okay, Christmas has come, let's celebrate, no? Oh, we sing some Christmas songs and so on. But yeah, that's the reality. At least in theory, we should know what's going on. As I think I said the other day, Srila Siddhar Maharaj says, there are no problems, there are only service opportunities. But the question is, how willing I am to serve. If I'm willing to serve, I will see service opportunities everywhere. If I'm not willing to serve, I will see problems everywhere. Even when there's no problem. But so the actual problem is that I'm not willing to serve. You follow? There are no problems outside. The only problem is I'm not willing to serve. The more I'm willing to serve, the less problems I perceive. Because that's the only problem. So I like to translate this verse by Kunti Devi as she's praying to Krishna, put me to test. No? I want to be put into test. Another way of saying, send me problems. Because problems are putting you into test. The Gita, the Bhagavatam, all these main books for us, what's the original stage they are presented? That's pretty challenging in both. Krishna telling Arjuna, kill all your family. Christ in the Bible says something similar. Maybe that's a quote that most people have overlooked. He says something like, if you want to follow me, he says, you have not only to abandon, but he said, you have to hate your family. Of course, you have to understand the idea, no? You have to understand the idea. We are not promoting hate your family. But he's promoting this idea of mundane attachment to so-called family. What's family? No? So the similar thing is with the Gita. Krishna is telling to Arjuna, kill your family. Of course, you have to understand Gita through parampara. If not, you become a serial killer, basically. You go home, Jai Mom, I'm following Krishna. Just that's not what Krishna is saying. He's saying the attachment that creates an illusory sense of connection, that has to be Poga Ishvarya Prashaktanam Taya Pahrita Chetasam Vyabhyasta Yabmikavudi Samadho Nabhidhiyate. You cannot have samadhi, you cannot achieve trance if you are too much attached to bhoga and aishwarya, enjoyment and opulence. If your mind is prasha ashaktanam, if you are attached to that, you won't attain the fixity of mind, one-pointedness that samadhi requires. And Bhagavatam, similarly, is a very uncomfortable situation. Parikshit is the emperor of the whole world. He has everything you can imagine. And he's a devotee, nice devotee with nice family, kingdom, everything running nicely. And suddenly you receive the news, you just have 1 week to live. That's kicking you out of the comfort zone. Imagine if I tell you, you have 7 days to live. Will you keep the same list of priorities you have today? So why don't you change the list now? Probably you have 7 days to live. Probably you have less. I was the other day walking in this silent section of the Ananda Dham that Krishna Chandra invited me. And there were some sections that I have really to be attentive where I was walking. I was thinking, well, what if I just sleep and fall, well, at least I left my body in Ananda Dham. But it can be any moment. The fact that Parikshit Maharaj have 7 days to live, actually I speak to us, you have 7 days to live. In one of these 7 days you will die. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. In one of these seven, you have to leave your body. Which one? We don't know. But if you don't live as if you will pass away at any moment, when the moment comes, you won't be prepared for that. That's the thing that Yudhishthira Maharaj says in the Mahabharata. That's the most astonishing thing in the whole universe. You may know the story. Today we are more in the Mahabharata side. No? All his other brothers, the other four Pandavas, they drank some poison water and they died, quote unquote. So in order for them to be revived, Yudhishthira Maharaj had to reply to a series of questions that were presented to them, but to him by one boy from the lake, which was Yamaraj. And many questions were presented. He had to be accurate in every question. If he failed one, his brothers will die. So then came the most important question. So the boys asked him, what's the most surprising, astonishing thing you find in this world? So try to imagine. You have to just say one thing, one correct thing. You cannot say many things. You have to just be totally accurate. And there are many astonishing things in this world. So where to begin? But Yudhishthira Maharaj, of course, he was a Raja Rishi. He was a sage and a king. So he was accurate. So he said the most astonishing thing that you can find ever in this world is that people is in this world and around oneself, everyone is dying. Being born, dying, every single day. You don't have an idea how many jivas left their body in this area of Ananda Nam every second. We sometimes don't think about those things. So he will say, a person is in this world and that's happening all around, all the time. But the person will think, that won't happen to me. Or he may say, yeah, that will happen, but not yet. So he continues living as if it will never happen. So Yudhishthira Maharaj said, that's the most astonishing thing I can say. And he passed the test. That was the correct answer. So my point is, Parikshit Maharaj was blessed in one sense. He had the news, 7 days. So he prepared. For us, it may come at any moment. So these are uncomfortable situations. At least if you are not prepared. If you are prepared, it's not uncomfortable. No? Parikshit Maharaj was prepared. So when the moment came, he didn't even realize that he left his body. Basically. He was in another place altogether. That's what Krishna says in the 8th chapter of the Gita. When he describes how different people prepare to leave their bodies. Those who prepare. Some of them will try to make arrangements to leave their body in certain particular influence, in the environment, certain astrological positions, to attain different situations. But then Krishna will say, but my devotee just absorbs in my service. And whenever death comes, he's absorbed in seva. He's so absorbed in seva that he, she may not realize that has left the body. He was not attentive to that. He was too much, he had too much to do in another direction. If you are really focused in something, so many things can happen around you. I didn't realize. So my point with all this, sorry for the extension, is that these main scriptures present these uncomfortable stages from which deep teachings come to us. So similarly, Kunti Devi or some personalities will voluntarily choose to enter non-comfort zone because I want to be put to test to see where I really am. Because if I remain in my comfort zone, I don't have a clue where I am. I think I am very advanced and I am very peaceful and I have great tolerance, but I need to be put to test. And then I will see where I actually am. You follow? And sometimes that can be painful because you realize, oh, I was not so transcendental as I thought. But you should celebrate because now you have a more realistic idea of where you are. So you can progress from there with more realism to your real goal. Because the process is not to cheat yourself thinking I am in a position that I am not. Even if you can convince everyone about that and yourself even, you still remain in wherever you are. So I will take this type of worship or conceptions in that particular way, no? Like voluntarily embracing challenge. But on a level again that is sustainable and it's not extremely dysfunctional and you get like abandoning all your worship basically. that makes no sense basically. And that can happen. I've seen the body sometimes like pushing too much. Like I don't know. I will take sannyas and they don't have the nature to take sannyas. So that's not helping them. And they are forcing a situation that is unnatural for them. So externally they remain as such, sannyas, but internally their mind is somewhere else, totally disturbed. So there's no need for that, that's the point. No need to create artificial situations. We are already probably in many artificial situations. So let's try to naturalize our present situation. And naturalizing sometimes is acknowledging our crackings, sincerity and so on. That's way more organic and sustainable, although it may be painful and uncomfortable in the beginning. For the ego, again, it should be a celebration for the soul, basically. Anuradha is raising her hand. Already I understood your...
She just has to leave.
Leaving there, friend. Okay.
But she arrived only.
See you in a few days, hopefully.
Prima.
Ja, ik ga nou.
Ja.
Ja, de.
Would you share with us how you personally put into practice the attitude towards the possibility of a death at any moment?
Yes. Well, in this life, I would say I've been blessed with some interesting clinical situation, which fortunately now is really quite sustainable. But since I've been 16 years old, I've been diagnosed with epilepsy. It's generally sustainable version of it, because there's people who has epileptic seizures 30 times a day, at any moment, anywhere. So in my case, maybe it was, I don't know, 3-4 times a year or something. And only when I am sleeping, which somehow makes it more safe. But anyhow, it's what I needed to receive in my case, the dose I have to deal with. And in those moments, I mean, it's just what it came to my mind. We could say some other things. But in those moments, when you are about to have a convulsion, do you say, seizure,
yeah.
You'll totally lose control of everything. All the body start to collapse. You cannot control the functions.
But you're conscious.
Till one point.
Yeah.
At one point you lose even that. So my point is, you realize how little you are in control. No matter how much I want to. So for me, these type of moments, which have happened, I don't know, multiplying maybe a few hundreds times, they are like a trailer of the moment of leaving my body, I would say. Because all the functions start to collapse. I have no control. And the only thing that remains is that thing that is my topmost priority in life. That, of course, I'm trying to culture during the rest of the day, hopefully. So, and I'm not saying that's an easy situation. And it's not that necessarily in every one of those cases you are just absorbing the flute song of Krishna or anything like that. Let's be realistic. But that's a force pushing out of the comfort zone for you to realize how fragile you are, how vulnerable you are, how very easily, even by some health situation, you may be like, phew, distracted, and how much you need to take this more seriously. Again, not with neurosis, but trying to realize how life works, no? And how much sometimes a test will come and may take you by surprise, probably. If it's a real challenge, probably it was not in your agenda. It's not that in your agenda you have, probably tomorrow I will have this challenge, I think. Probably not. You were not expecting that. So for me, basically the main meditation, there is this idea of what this aspect of Saranagati called Goptritui Varanam. Rakshishati Vishwasu Goptritui Varanam Tata. I trust that Krishna is my protector. And try to enter into this feeling, because it's a whole meditation you have to enter in. It's not just saying that. Krishna is my protector. Yes, but how much we feel that, how much we feel his protection at every step, especially in those moments that are challenging us. Especially Krishna is protecting us there. So I try to enter deeply into meditation in those directions. Krishna is protecting me. Krishna is maintaining me. And to be honest, he replies. No, it's not that you feel, oh, I'm just forcing my own imagination and speculating. No, that's taking place. And even if something difficult happened, even if during the moment of the difficulty I'm not able to see in which way Krishna is protecting me here, at least I try to pray to remain having that trust, that confidence. I don't know why, how, why, but I know it's taking place. And after some time, the challenge has passed, you look back, and somehow he shows you this was the reason for the whole thing. And you're like, oh, yes. It makes perfect sense. And you start to think, how could I not see that before? Now it sounds so obvious, but in the moment we were just looking like this to reality, no? Like looking on the keyhole, no? And like this, open the door. But we want to see reality through a keyhole, and Krishna opens the door and wants to give the bigger picture. So it may take time to process the bigger picture. So with this, I'm not giving you some magical formula. You swallow this pill and immediately you transcend the fear of death or things like this, but it's important to prepare ourselves for that. To live our life in the context of death, if you will. Of course, death means, as we say, changing the cloth. There's no actual death, literally. So for me, this idea came a long time ago. Death put lives in context. Death puts life in context. If you take death out of the equation, life becomes decontextualized.
And shallow.
Exactly. I was recently reading one article, at least some years ago was the article, maybe that's the statistics changed. But a few years ago, there was one country called Bhutan or something like that. Yeah. And that's, according to the statistic, is the happiest country in the world. And the main reason for that is that they have a whole culture of death, where it's part of the daily life of everyone constantly. And again, this is not that they are like obscure people, black mind, death, obsession, but just it's present. It's the awareness of it, it's on a daily basis present in everyone's life, in a natural way. And that gives them, as Krishna Chandra Prabhu said, depth to life. They value each moment, they go through each situation from a perspective that goes even beyond death. We in particular have our philosophy, which clearly shows us death is just a misunderstanding. Strictly speaking, there is no death. So when we speak about death, it's just a misreading of reality. Nothing is dying. Even matter is not dying. It's just changing forms. Whatever exists will always exist. Whatever doesn't exist will never exist. That's our philosophy. We don't follow creatio ex nihilo. From nothing came something. Whatever exists always exists. So it's important that you... And I remember also having this epiphany almost one of the first days in the temple. Those epiphanies that you cannot just expect. And when the Buddha was giving the class and basically say something simple like, but deep, like, we are eternal. But epiphany. It was like, of course, I've heard already that quote so many times, but it opened a portal in such a way that I really felt I'm eternal. And from that moment, it was like, there's nothing to fear. I'm eternal. There's nothing to lose, nothing to fear. No. The idea of fear, it's a misreading of reality. So, of course, again, you can only transcend the fear of death, if you acquire proper vision, proper realization. It's not just a few bunch of concepts. It may begin with some concepts, but those concepts should take you to practice. And through practice, you acquire realization. And one of the tathasta lakshan, or indirect byproducts of your sadhana, is stop having fear of death, for example, even without looking for them. Yad bibeti swayam bayam, says the Bhagavatam. Even fear personified is fearing Bhagavan, who comes in the holy name in such a merciful way. No? So, I would say that that's at least for me the best formula. Counteract fear with the opposite of it, which is trust and confidence. Faith. With proper faith, you will no longer remain in the land of doubt. No problem. Have to take care of our sadhagadeha. Okay, 1 hour already, so I don't know if there is something else. Moses have something. Okay, we have time.
Yes. Okay. In connection that you said we should practice, like we could die very soon, but then it's not according to our eligibility or adhikar, right? So we will chant probably more, if it would be really like this, if we would die soon.
I mean, the point I meant was, of course, it's not just to make death like your main udipana, no? Like, okay, I may die at any moment, so I better chant more seriously because, no? Because, like, again, we were speaking these days, at one point, we don't care, we know we may return to this world and be born again as an insect, like Brahma said, but if bhakti is there, okay. So, when I say this point is just, if you realize I'm really attached to this body, I'm really attached to the extensions of my body in the form of ties and possessions, this all sense of I constructed on the basis of a sense of mine, then you have to start to contemplate a little bit this, to have this kind of jnana perspective for a minute. Krishna starts the Gita on that platform to begin with, like, try to understand the temporality of things. This is not, in one sense, the essence of bhakti, but it's one little philosophical aspect that may help on certain level of our practice to have proper sobriety, if you will, while we interact with things. Because again, it's easy to say, everything is energy of Krishna, we will use everything for his service. That's not so easy to do. So in the beginning, we may need to understand what's what. As I said the other day, Krishna says, "Asas dukkala yam asas patam." The world is miserable and temporary.
Vishvapurna sukhayate.
And then, on another level, Vishvapurna sukhayate. The world is full of bliss. So, what? Yes, miserable and temporary for those who are attached to it as permanent. You follow? If I get attached to this flower, as beautiful as it is, at one point it will... So if I pretend this to be permanent, it will be miserable. But not because it is miserable in itself, because my attachment to it, my expectation that this temporary thing is permanent, creates the misery. The misery is not in the flower, but it's in my own wrong expectation. You follow? We are eternal beings, so naturally we are looking for something eternal. But when we are not properly enlightened, we go to the temporary reality and wait that things behave in the same way we are. We are eternal, so we expect everything to be eternal, but it is not, in that same one sense. So then comes misery. So in that sense, it's good to have that basic idea, understanding. But that's, again, that's a beginning point. On a higher point, even though things can be all of them engaged in the service of Krishna, and it takes another perspective altogether. But sometimes that higher perspective is not easy to arrive just in one shot. So that's why we may need some sequential instruction. For some it may not be necessary, but for some it may. If you go to the Bhagavatam, there are lots of those type of instructions. It's not only Rasa Lila in the Bhagavatam. Of course, that's the zenith of the Bhagavatam, but you have to go through all the other things. If you have not learned the lessons of Chitraketu Maharaj and who knows what, you name them. Parikshit, Dhruva, all of them, they are personifying some of these things. So you have to pass through all of them, and then you can really speak about Rasa Lila. You have a question?
Yeah.
Or commentary?
Yeah, I was wondering that, where are all the gopis in the Gaur Lila? The incarnations are all males. I see the Manjaris. They were Manjaris and they come back as Goswamis.
Mm-hmm.
And also now in the Gaudiya Math, there is more the male presence than the female. So, but we go back to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In that time, they're all, even Srimati Radhika comes back as Gadada.
Mm-hmm.
So, where are the females?
In Gaur Lila.
Yeah. I'm not speaking about Sachimata.
Yeah. Well, I just to begin with say we have to understand that when we speak about Gaur Lila or Krishna Lila, we are not speaking about male or female,
yes,
to begin with. That's enough?
Yes. But...
Of course, there is a way of speaking about male and female in transcendence, but it's not the same masculinity and femininity as we know it on this side. So we should be careful of not projecting this type of sensibilities into the higher realm, because it doesn't work in the same way. No? In one sense, you can say there's only, sometimes this idea is male. One male, everyone is female, this idea of Purusha and Prakriti. There are different ways of using these ideas. And of course, there are different ways of abusing these ideas as well. And I personally think that big part of our Gaudiya community, is quite chauvinist. And there is not enough emphasis on the feminine side. In general, the feminine side in general. No? So, in that sense, I agree. But my point is, if we go to Gaur Lila, all these males, if you will, there, are not chauvinist. No? They have their female sensibilities in place, if you want to put it like that.
Yes.
They're properly, and they're taking a particular form according to the mood in which Bhagavan is in that particular Lila. No, the point is, Gaur Lila is Krishna Lila. In one sense, there's no difference between the two, because Gaur is Krishna. Gaur Krishna, we call him now. No? Black Sham Krishna Sham Sundar became Gaur Sundar. Like I like to say, you have this quote in English, like, something is the new black. Have you heard that quote? I don't know if you use it here. Okay, there's a way of saying something in English that such and such thing, whatever it may be, is the new black. No? Like something which is now in fashion, that people is using that, is the new black. So we will say golden is the new black. No. Gaur is the new sham, if you will. So it's the same person. Gaur, Krishna. So, in one sense, it's the same Lila. Mm-hmm. Vrindavan, Navadvip, non-different between themselves. Gaur Lila, Krishna Lila are the same. There are some differences in terms of, how to say, the proportion of certain moods, how they express in one Lila and in the other. My Guru Maharaj likes to make an interesting comparison. He say, Gaur Lila and Krishna Lila are like a reversible jacket. You know what's a reversible jacket,
yes,
no?
You can wear it from both
sides. So on one side the jacket is golden and it has black sleeves, no? And on the other side is black with golden sleeves. So the proportion of the colors will vary in one side, but it's the same jacket, just from one side or from the other. So in Gaur Lila you have Audarya in predominance, and Krishna Lila Madhurya predominance, but it's the same Lila. So my point is, but in Gaur Lila, Krishna is... It's another topic altogether. It's an interesting topic for sure. I'm writing a book about this. So I'm trying to check myself because this may be the longest class ever. So, in Gaur Lila, we have Krishna totally dedicated to a new experiment. Gaur Lila is like a big laboratory. In Krishna's entering with the very unique curiosity of, I want to taste Radha Bhav. I want to make my Braja Lila full and successful. Because in Vrindavan, Braja Lila, in the words of Krishna Dhaka Vraj Goswami, Krishna feels, my Braja Lila was a failure. I wanted to try certain things, but I couldn't fully grasp all that I wanted to taste. And Krishna said, but I'm Rasaraj. I'm the king of taste. But I couldn't taste all that I wanted to taste in Braj. So for this I need a whole another Lila. I need an extension of Vrindavan that may facilitate that experience. So it's the same lila in one sense. It's the same Vrindavan, but adopting a particular form to facilitate Krishna's experience of tasting Radha-bhava. So everyone else in the Braj adapts to specific positions to facilitate that experience of Krishna tasting Radha-bhava. Radha included, as we know. Asgaladhar Pandit. Which is a whole different topic, very deep, very esoteric, to speak about Gorgadadhar. Let's see if that comes down these days. Very, very, the most topmost confidential tattva, I may dare to say. So my point is, Mahaprabhu is in a certain mood. Mahaprabhu is Krishna in the mood of a sadhaka wanting to taste gopi bhav. So he wants to be a gopi, if you will. So everyone else will adjust and appear in a particular form and identity so he can become that. So basically, manjaris like Rupa Goswami and some others, or even Radha as Gadadhar, all of them appear in the particular form they appear as sadhakas, closely assisting Mahaprabhu, who eventually, at least on earth, accepts sannyas. So as we know, sannyasi won't be like closely associated with ladies intimately. But Mahaprabhu's sannyas is also tied to his inner purpose of tasting Radha-bhava, not only to external purpose. So he has to have some close associates that will facilitate that. And as we know, Mahaprabhu on earth, he becomes successful in tasting Radha-bhava as a sannyasi in the Gambira, where he no longer associates not with lady, but with anyone practically. He stops being a public person almost 100% in the Gambira. That's where he fully tastes Radha-bhava. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami quotes, when he's quoting the Sikshastakam at the end of Chaitanya Charitamrita, he quotes the last verse of Sikshastakam. That's the last chapter of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's the end of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. The curtain is closing. And when he quotes the last verse, he said, this verse was spoken by Radha herself. So he's implying, Mahaprabhu did it, tasted Radha-bhava fully. And that's the closing of Gaur Lila. He was successful. Of course, Radha's bhava is a bottomless ocean. So how much you can fully taste that?
That's why Gaur Lila is eternal.
That's why Gaur Lila is eternal. We are on the same page with Krishna Chandra. When I wrote a series of articles some years ago about the reasons why Gaur Lila is eternal, my main reason was because Radha's bhava is endless. So there has to be an eternal place where Krishna is eternally dedicated to taste that, and it never ends. That's the main logic, reasoning for the eternality of Gaur Lila. So my point is this, all these manjaris or gopis in Braja Lila adopt corresponding forms, corresponding to the mood in which Krishna is, as Mahaprabhu, as a sannyasi, to assist him, and because he needs help, he cannot do it by himself. We know the help he needs from so many. Ramananda, Swarup, Gadadhar, and so on. So they take the suitable forms so they can be with him in intimacy and assist like that. So I think that's a very interesting point. Like, when we serve any form of Bhagavan, we should serve that form according to the mood Bhagavan is in. You follow? So if Bhagavan has in mind some particular project, like tasting Radha-bhava, we will try to enter in a mood that will help for him to get to that project. If Krishna's Mahaprabhu wants this to take Radha-bhava, we won't approach him trying to relate with him in a conjugal relationship. Although those tendencies may be there. There are some practitioners who like to think of Mahaprabhu as such. No? They say, well, Mahaprabhu is Krishna. So if Mahaprabhu is Krishna, we can relate with Krishna in Parakiya. So let's try the same with Mahaprabhu. Why not? Why not? What will you say to that?
No.
Not Krishna Chandra. He knows the answer. Why not? Why not Krishna Chandra Prabhu? Well, what will you say?
Because it's not fulfilling his purpose of becoming Rasaraj. Because that side, as Vishayalamban, as the enjoyer, he already tasted in Braj. But now he wants to have Ashrayalamban. And it needs something new. That's why the whole arrangement by Yogamaya was made, that the door of Gaur, of Navadvip, was opened. So if he would fall back into the same mood, then actually it would be no Navadvip, no need of Navadvip.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, the very purpose of the Gaur Lila will be
exactly finished.
Yeah.
That's why he had to leave Vrindavan also very quickly.
Yeah, sorry?
That's why he had to leave Vrindavan also very quickly.
Yeah, that's how acharyas have also experienced that. That way he stays so many few days there. Because he was constantly reminded of some things that were getting in the way of what he wanted to taste. Interesting. So again, this is a fine point, but that applies to everything. Now, if we approach to serve someone, we have to understand which is the mood that I should offer my service to that person. What's the necessity of the moment, as we spoke the other day? I have to serve according to the necessity of the moment, not to my necessity, to what I like. I think about what's going on, what's required here. That requires very sensitive considerations, not just projecting our own mentality, if you will, no? So in that sense, Gaur Lila is very, very delicate. No? Many times I've heard sadhu saying that the service rendered in Gaur Lila is way more delicate than even in Braja Lila, because there Krishna is in a very sensitive moment, if you will. That's why Swarup Damodar was always filtering whatever was offered to Mahaprabhu, because he knew his relation is something so delicate, so fine, that whatever is out of place in presented to him, that may create big disturbance. So we don't want to disturb the mood of Gaur, basically. We want to nourish that. So, anyhow, some consideration. Yeah.
Just in this connection, there's like two ways of approaching Leela in totally. Some say, oh, and we see it also in practice. There's some branches of Gaudiyas. They say, oh, first become pure, or more pure, and little detached of identifications. And because if you don't do that, then by forcefully you will understand the Leela on a projective level of thinking it's in connection to this mortal world. And others say, no, enter, because if you're not approaching the ultimate goal, the ultimate love, even though you're not completely pure, you will have never ever a chance of becoming free of your upadhi, because the biggest upadhi is indifference towards your lila. So what is your approach?
I would say something in between those two.
Es gibt so zwei Arten, wie man ins Lila herangeht. Einige sagen, du sollst noch nicht sich mit dem Lila beschäftigen, weil wenn du nicht noch Identifikation hast mit der Welt, weil sonst bist du gezwungen, das, was du über das Lila von Bhagavan hörst, in Beziehung zu setzen zu deinen Höllen, und dann denkst du, das hätte irgendetwas mit der vergänglichen Welt zu tun, und dann machst du praktisch das Schlimmste, was du machen kannst. Du tust das überlagern mit eigener Projektion. Und deswegen sagen einige, nee, beschäftige dich nicht damit, beschäftige dich mit Loslösung und einfach mal Sharanagati und Hingabe. Und andere sagen, nein, du musst dich damit auseinandersetzen, weil wenn du nicht mit Sadhya, was du mit der letztlichen Substanz in Kontakt kommst, wirst du gar nie zur Seele gelangen, weil das tiefste Upadhi, die tiefste Designation, die du in dir trägst, ist ja genau die Gleichgültigkeit und die Nicht-Auseinandersetzung mit dem ewigen Lila.
Ja,
auf
jeden Fall. Ist das klar für alle? Weil es ist ein total wichtiger Punkt.
Oh, she says, is it clear for everyone? It's an important question.
Das versteht man entweder jetzt oder ja. Das Vorwissen, was man dafür braucht, wenn man das jetzt nicht versteht, das kannst du nicht mal in 10 Stunden auflösen.
Aber lass sie doch noch mal kurz die Frage.
Es geht doch nur darum, also
she's again repeats. She thinks it's such an important question.
Manchmal denkt man, oh, diese ganzen Lilas, krass, oh, was wir hier hören. Ne?
All
so,
these Lilas
über die transzendentale Welt.
About the transcendental world.
Ja, also
No, bitte, Anuradha, ich übersetze ihm auch gerade, das ist gut.
Wenn wir schon das erklären, das
schön.
Ja, aber dann hast du mich unterbrochen und hast dann gar nicht gehört, was ich zur Erklärung gesagt habe.
Okay.
Also, alles, was ich hier über die transzendentale Welt
Everything
höre,
that I hear about the transcendental world.
Und, oder das ist so vertraulich, oder?
It's
das
so
das Spiel Gottes und seine ganzen Gefährten, und darüber, was ich angeblich als Seele bin, dort auch.
As a soul,
das ist so komplex und so
it's
hoch.
So complex and so high.
Dann kann es sein, dass man mit der
it
Zeit das Gefühl bekommt,
ey,
wo stehe ich, wenn ich mich damit vergleiche, oder wo was ich hier die ganze Zeit höre, dann sehe ich, dazu bin ich noch lange nicht bereit.
Oh, I'm not even ready
sorry,
for
ich muss
that
erst mal realisieren, dass ich eine Seele
I
bin,
first
oder?
Have to realize
und
that I'm a soul.
Praktizieren von dieser Welt.
The detachment
und dann
of this
vielleicht
world.
Macht es Sinn, mich irgendwann mal auch wirklich mit dieser Transzendenz und dem ganz hohen Inhalt zu beschäftigen. Das ist der eine Ansatz.
This is the one perspective.
Demgegenüber gibt es den anderen
Ansatz. The other perspective.
Der sagt, ja, okay,
like
ich erkenne das an, wo ich jetzt stehe. Ich sehe das auch klar. Es gibt eine gewisse Gefahr, so wie
yeah,
ich gerade geschaffen bin, dass ich dann, wenn ich von diesen transzendentalen Wahrheiten und der ganzen Welt von Krishna so höre,
Krishna's
dass ich das natürlich dann mit meinem Geist alles bebildere,
I make an image
aber
macht
nichts.
Mind, but I'm not
ich vertraue darauf, dass das die Beschäftigung damit und das darüber hören, das Heilmittel ist. Der einzige
healing,
Weg, dass diese Loslösung, die mir auch klar ist, die passieren muss, dass die geschieht.
Then I will become detached from
diese
the
beiden Ansätze gibt es.
So these are the two perspectives.
Und Herangehensweisen, oder? Und es ist, ich habe deswegen nochmal mitgebracht, weil ich glaube, es ist so ein zentraler Punkt. Auch
I think it's a very central point, where to
man
understand how to
eigentlich
how to approach the
Leben. Das glaube ich tief.
Gibt es da nicht den mittleren Weg? Also
I have got gesagt.
Okay.
Somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Sorry?
You just, your first answer is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, when I say somewhere in the middle, I say that considering that, I mean, you will find many types of practitioners. So some practitioners may be too extreme to one thing or to the other also. To the point of demonizing confidential topics or to the point of presenting them in a very casual or cheap way without proper grounding in philosophy. So when we speak about we have been speaking these days about the Lila of Bhagavan, especially the Nara Lila, which is human-like Lila. So for us as humans, that probably will be especially charming, because we are humans. So we can create some emotional bond with the Lila. But also is the risk is there to think what he's doing is what I'm doing also. If you just read casually. But if you study in detail the Lila, and with proper guidance, then you will realize that that's not ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this emphasis has been over and over again established in our tradition. You have to hear the things from the lips of someone who has proper understanding of the lila. So if you have proper understanding of the hear from someone who has proper understanding, you will have proper understanding. And you will be charmed, but not confused. And part of that understanding will be also to understand where is the lila and where I am also. So you don't imitate or think, I'm there, or I'm almost there in 2 minutes. Probably we need to work on some other things. But we will be working on those things with the idea of entering that lila in mind. So I spoke, I think, today in the morning. In one sense, we have to establish sadhya first, and then we can develop in detail sadhana, at least on some level. So one sense to establish sadhya, or the goal to attain, means to speak about lila. Yeah, we were thinking about this famous verse at Phala Shruti of the Rasa Panchadhyaya. Mikriditam Rajabadu Viridham Chavishnu, and so on. And of course, there's the word dhira in that verse, no? Dhira. Bhaktim Param Bhagavati Pati Lavakam Hit Rogam Aswa Pahinotya Chirena Dhira. That's the last word of the whole Rasa Panchadhyaya, dhira. That's interesting. Dhira means like sober, a person who is sober. And interestingly, there are different ways that sadhus explain this verse. Some will say, first become dhira, and then you can hear, take benefit from these sections. But others will say, by hearing these sections, you will become dhira. And of course, our path of bhakti is not about jnana or vairagya, but it's about bhakti. Bhakti is mostly characterized by shravan, kirtan, smaran. And by doing that, will come the proper knowledge and detachment. Vasudevi pura bhagavati bhakti yoga prayojita janayatyasu vairagyam janam chayadahaitukam. So by engaging in bhakti, the byproduct of that will be proper knowledge, proper detachment of unnecessary things, and so on. Of course, this doesn't mean that if you are coming to the temple for the first day, I will give you the Gita Govinda or something like this. It may be too much. But it doesn't mean that we will completely hide every single aspect of the lila of Krishna. Because there are levels of that. When we say the lila of Krishna, there are different levels in which you can speak about that also. It's not that, I don't know. You can speak about rasa lila in an introductory level. No? A level, B level, C level, D level, E level, and there's no limit to that. And a speaker should also be attentive to the adhikar of the audience. That's also a fact. Because some people may want to hear those things with the wrong reasons also. That can happen. That has happened. So in that case, many of our acharyas have closed their mouths because they felt we are not open to hear about this with the right commitment. You just want to be entertained. And Lila is not to entertain us. Lila is to commit us. To create commitment in us. It's not just let's have some fun and hear some stories or something like this.
No. Something that's very deep, that you say. That's why I am...
You stopped translating?
Hesitated.
Okay. Yes.
You said Lila is to create commitment.
Yeah, right? Of course. Not entertainment. We are not here to sorry?
Yeah, just translate.
It's not just... So we have to examine ourselves when we are hearing Lila, which is the result of that at the end. I'm more committed or I'm just like having fun and entertaining. I mean, you go to India and there's people who love to hear Krishna Lila and there's all these Bhagavad Saptahas made everywhere. But many of those people are not committing themselves to the Lila. It's just like a form of entertainment. After the session is over, they continue their lives normally. Like watching Netflix for a while. Okay, now they continue. No change of heart. So that's not the way to approach Lila, of course. That's why sometimes it's helpful to go to Gaur Lila. Because in Gaur Lila you find all the main players of Krishna Lila are in Gaur Lila. In Krishna Lila, it may be difficult for some of us to see the level of commitment they have. Externally it may seem they are just enjoying life, having fun. But actually there is deep commitment. It is said that each one of the manjaris, narmasakas, they are willing to give up their lives millions of times to create the union of Radha and Krishna one more day. That's their willingness, that's their disposition. They are ready to die a million times if that's required. So that's deep commitment, their deep identification with the necessity of the moment. But for some of us it may seem like they're just playing, having fun. But you go to Gaur Lila and you see how they behave as sadhakas. You want to study the life of Raghunath Das Goswami. That means to be a manjari. How seriously he's conducting, how deep he is in his prayers, in his longing, in his bratas, in his commitments. And that's showing all, that what you can see more easily in Gaur Lila, all that is present in Braja Lila. Although you may not be seeing it. So again, there's nothing against hearing the Lila, but there is a way to approach that in a way that is creating the desired result. It's not hearing just casually, it's not hearing just from any source, but the source has to be walking the talk and the audience have to be committed to the discourse. It's not just I will just put in YouTube and see who is speaking Lila. No, let's see. But ideally, you hear from someone that you are committing to. There's a commitment with the person you are hearing from. There's a relationship of service. It's not just I sit, oh, nice harikata, okay, goodbye. And you, no. Ideally, there has to be some heart to heart connection. So, again, if that's there is no harm in hearing Lila. Because you will draw so much benefit from that. You will appreciate so much depth, so much commitment, so much love, so much surrender, so much charming ideals that will totally capture your heart forever. That's the idea. That's the uniqueness of Leela, especially Krishna Leela, Braja Leela, Gaur Leela, for that matter. But again, you can go to those same Leelas and conclude, as some people has concluded, for example, some British when they were in India, you are worshipping a playboy god, a womanizer. Hmm? They went to study the Leela from a scholarly perspective. They took Bhagavatam and they thought, these people are totally degraded. They compare with the Christian sense of purity, and for them this Krishna is, unlimited young girls who are married with someone else, and meeting with one single guy during the night. This is almost pornographic. And many people took devotees to the court, even. There's one famous case, I think it was in Eastern Europe, maybe Poland or Bulgaria, somewhere, which a nun knew about the Bhagavatam, and she thought, this is totally this is hellish. Many of the British, when they went to India, they heard about bhakti, Vaishnavism in general, said, oh, it's nice, it seems like Christianity, it's monotheistic, it's devotional, but when they get to the Bhagavatam, they feel, oh, the whole thing went to hell here. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that himself. In his story, Swalikita Jivan, he will say, I was raised as a European, basically, with British education in India, and I had a special distaste for one book, he said, the Bhagavatam. Yeah, because that was the impressions he received from the British. This is the Antichrist personified or something like that. So, again, it can be, if you take it literally, it can be misread in many sections. So this nun took the devotees to the court. Try to imagine. And the nun was quoting so many passages in front of the judge. Look at this Krishna marrying all these queens and all these ladies who are single and these have husbands. It gets worse and worse. For hours, providing evidence, quote unquote. And then the devotee has to present his case. Maybe you heard this famous story. And the Buddha says, I only have one question to make to the nun. That's the only thing I will say. After the nun spoke for hours and hours and hours. So what's your question? What's the question? So the Buddha asked the nun, you have one ring, right? The nun said, yes. What's the meaning of the ring? And she said, and she was not answering. She wasn't answering. So the judge tell, you have to answer the question. So she replied, he put her head down and say, this means that I'm married with Jesus Christ. So they both say, I don't have anything else to ask. Because the point is, if all the nuns in the world are married with Christ, Christ is much more of a womanizer than Krishna. But of course we understand which type of marriage we are speaking about in this case.
Yeah, we understand, but she didn't.
That's the point. We understand. Hopefully. So it's a marriage between the soul and its source, if you want to put it like that. So my point again is, Leela can take you to wrong understandings. Not the Leela in itself, but our lack of capacity to deal with that. Because it's very confidential. So something very intimate, where God seems to be a human, you need very special support to not read that in a wrong way. So I would make that main emphasis there. Not so much the main emphasis is do not hear that or hear that, but the main emphasis is hear that with the proper guidance and association. And being sincere yourself about where you are standing. Because, to be honest, sometimes I've seen devotees who in their own process, in their own journey, they have to solve some psychological, emotional issues in their lives. And for them, it's not enough just to hear Rasa Leela. They may need therapy. You follow? So for some of them, instead of hearing Rasa Leela, they may need to hear other things. so they can take proper advantage of Rasa Lila. If not, they may project psychological dysfunctionality in the Lila. You follow my point? So yeah, Lila is the highest thing, the purest thing, but also, what capacity do I have to deal with that? I have to ask that to myself on some level also. And the one who is teaching Lila should put to test the hearer to see how much you are understanding. Sukadeva Goswami did that to Parikshit many times in the Bhagavatam. And at the end of the fifth canto, when the hellish planets are described, another discussion altogether. Sukadeva Goswami, Parikshit Maharaj is filled with compassion. He asked Sukadeva Goswami, how can a living entity be freed from such a suffering? And Sukadeva Goswami tested Parikshit Maharaj, beginning of sixth canto, said, by karma, you can be free from all suffering.
By pious activity.
Yeah, in that sense. And Parikshit Maharaj said, no. According to what you taught me till now, that's not the answer.
You're wrong.
So Sukadeva Goswami recommended Gyan. By Gyan, by Gyan, all the suffering will go away. So still he's scanning his student. Let's see how well he was hearing. Parikshit Maharaj said, no. By Gyan is not possible because of these that you taught me before. It's not possible. Sukadeva is, And then he tells the story of Ajamil and stalling the glories of Bhakti and Sri Harinam. So in this way, the teacher, Jiva Goswami says this in the Bhakti Sandarbha. He says, he speaks about the lower teacher, if you will, and a higher teacher. And he said the lower teacher is not conducting tests. And this can have two applications. The teacher is not testing the disciple. We already spoke about test. But testing even in this sense, how well you understood what I'm telling you. Or the guru is not testing himself. How much I'm speaking about something that I'm actually practicing. That's even more subtle. Because, as I say, I think the other day, you can become expert in speaking. That's not so difficult, relatively. You can become expert in telling others what to do. But not be expert in you yourself doing those things you are telling others to do. So that's another type of test that the teacher should conduct with himself, herself. How much I'm walking the talk. How much I'm balancing my speech with my practice. That's why I personally, since I open my mouth too much every day, I'm telling people, blah, 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 blah. Sometimes I need to enter my room, close the door, and disappear for a few hours, so I try to, okay, let's see how much do I believe these things that I'm telling others, how much I'm practicing, how much do I walk in my talk. Because if not, you become a hypocrite. I was speaking last year when I was in Vrindavan and visited Radha Kund a few weeks in Kartik. We were speaking at one point with Vaishnava Pad Das Babaji. He's one of the main students of Ananta Das Babaji. It was a nice talk. And he was telling me that he's teaching his students the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and they're singing his Kirtan and so on. And at one point he told me, because he was giving at that time, I think, 3 lectures per day, the whole Kartik, with many people. So he would tell, I can speak to thousands of people every lecture 3 times a day. No problem. It's easy for me. And it's not something complicated. But to sit and do bhajan, that's complicated. That's not easy. He made that point like strongly. No? To sit and tell others thing, that's easy. But to sit and do bhajan, that's not easy. Like implying you have to compensate the two. You have to balance one with the other. So all this in connection to these topics also, no? Because it may be relatively easy to speak. Let's speak about the highest thing possible. But where I am, the speaker, in terms of the content of that speech also, in terms of commitment and etc. So in this, that's a long explanation to my first initial word, that is something between the two things. Of course, we could say many more things, but something about that.
I have a question. It's in a sense personal, it's not theoretical, but practical, and it's related to what you spoke yesterday in the podcast with how to deal with social media. And it has to do with my behavior I have since 2 years, which is condemned by most of the devotees for good reasons, and even many non-devotees condemn this, what I'm doing. I have lost from my 900 Facebook friends 800. In the shape because I presented this, which I will, and I first give the reasons why I'm doing this, and then just give me 1 minute to explain. And I just wanted to make you curious about
yes, first, you're doing it,
and the others also.
Yes.
And it's actually, I have this question at least since 2 years, and I've only answered it myself, and this is the first time, and I'm showing this way great respect and appreciation for you, because it's the first time that I'm presenting it to some other devotees and asking actually for advice, and it's the first time also that I'm ready to question what I'm doing, and to question also the reasons that I have. So, my arguments for what I'm doing is, for example, there's the, and actually I'm posing this question also to Krishna Chandra, that I would like you to answer this question in a week or in 2 weeks. Not now, because it will then disturb the start. I want to hear only from you now.
Okay.
So in the 16th chapter, actually it's called Dadim Asulim Yoga.
Sampada Yoga.
Eh?
Daivasura Sampada Daiva
Yoga. Sampada Yoga, exactly, that's the word. So it's a kind of yoga, a connection with Krishna, with the divine, to be able to differentiate between that which is demonic and that which is godly. So in every age, there are different processes and different challenges. So in Kali Yuga, we have this chance, especially we're confronted with the necessity of Tattva Viveka, or of this being able to differentiate between that which is divine and which is demonic. And it's not unimportant. Krishna spends a lot of time, not only in the 16th chapter, but in many other chapters, to help us to differentiate, not only to recognize it outside, but also in us. So our 50%, as you have been mentioning, in our approach to God, a part of that is also to be able to differentiate. For example, also Bhaktisiddhanta, we are praising him every day, that he is Apasiddhanta Harini, that he is destroying,
removing
mentalities which appear like something benevolent and even spiritual and even on bhakti, and then which are mixed actually with the kind of apparat or with a non-devotional mentality. And he even said it's more important to destroy, to defeat this opposite and this wrong conception as to establish which is right. I don't agree with that, but he said like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think both is important.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's nice that he stressed this point, and it's convenient for me, so I'm quoting him here. So my point, I come slowly. So to listen to a demon and appreciate him as a great saint, that matters. It's not irrelevant that I cannot differentiate.
Did you start with to listen to a demon?
Yeah, if I listen to a demon and his instructions, and I don't recognize this is demonic, but I think, oh, this is nice, this is such a nice person, benevolent, I believe him. So this is not only bad for my life, but it is also harmful for my spiritual life. And Krishna was trying to prepare me for this, to recognize this thing. For example, there is one person, he presents himself as God, and he calls his a Bhakti Mart. And we have paid some of his disciples to go sing at our Bhakti festival, to do bhajans, and they are not, I see this man as a demon. Bhakti Thakur would put him right away in a prison. but I don't see his disciples as such. They are just misguided people. I don't know all of them, but those that I've seen, and I got, unfortunately, much contact with them. So, Srila Prabhupada, in his one very important basic instruction that even is on a long play record, he says, just as milk becomes poisoned by being touched by the lips of a serpent, similarly, the holy name should be heard from a pure devotee. If it is heard from someone else, it has, I don't know what he says, but it has a negative, it has a poisonous effect. So it matters to whom we choose to listen. And Krishna Chandra and I, we have a devotee friend, he was here last year, who thinks that three of those persons that I believe are the worst demonic and powerful persons on this earth right now, that they are good and benevolent, and we should adapt their agenda. Embrace, for example, the vaccines and their plans for the great reset. I've listened to him, to this friend, I've read his articles, and listened to these three demons. And so now comes my very questionable behavior. I spent for months, 5 hours every day, doing research. Because my wife and my child, although I'm living separate from them, I'm on a cluster stage, trust me, and many of my friends do, and all of us have been forced to make a decision. So do I take the vaccine or not? If not, there are heavy consequences. For example, my son, he didn't take it, and he got expelled from his very nice job. So we can't stay neutral. So better we take a well-informed decision from someone who has listened well to both sides. But this is not my question. No, my question is not whether we should take the vaccine or not. That should be left up to everyone freely to decide. My question is, was it part of my naimittic dharma to do my research for me and especially for other devotees who I tried to warn, and many of them accepted, also many here in our ashram, they wanted to take the vaccine, and I could
Save them.
I informed them, and then, not from my, what I convinced them of my arguments, but I sent them information. So, my question, should we just follow the mainstream, even if they are guided by, as Prabhupada said, blinded fools and rascals? Does it not also harm our spiritual life if we don't put the words of Krishna into practice and differentiate between right or wrong, good and evil? That's my question.
So my reply will be, should be basically yes or no. Right? Because the last question is more like, should we do this or not?
No, my question is, I believe that it is important to differentiate between something which is benevolent and divine and something which is demonic.
Yes.
So, is it possible that for someone who is not very advanced, who is not at the stage of Sarvadananda Richa Jama Mekam Sarvamarja, but who has to follow also his Naimiti Grama at the same time aspiring for Sarvadananda Richa Jama? So, could this behavior, which is condemned by most devotees, actually be part of my Namitic Dharma, in my responsibility to warn other friends and to my wife and child also and others? Or was I just in my and justifying it? I was not enjoying it. I was really doing it in the spirit of this is really ugly, and I really found out very ugly things and distasteful. So I was not doing it to enjoy it, but maybe I'm completely wrong. I thought this is my duty. I'm confronted with this. I have to make a decision. So which I have to be well informed to make the right decision and to help others to make the right decision.
Well, I would say that, of course, to begin with, it's a personal question. You know, you're asking about something you have been doing yourself. And on many levels, it's not so much sometimes about what we do, but also which is the background of what we do, the intention why we do. And in one sense, of course, I'm starting to know you for the last 4 days or so. So, in one sense, my point is, I don't like to give too much of an opinion about someone that I don't know in detail, because you need to know a person also to share a public opinion, online opinion, about why, if what someone did was properly motivated or wrong. I mean, there's so many details to first grasp. As you did your research for your thing, I should do my research about what your research to share a more realistic opinion. I don't like to cheaply say it was wrong, Trivanga, nor to say great, because it's not for me only black and white. There's sometimes made so many other things in between, in the background, that we need to take the time to explore them and find them to reach a more rich, comprehensive perspective of the whole thing. So, personally, I don't feel too much like... I don't like to do that because I see so many people doing that, you know, like sharing conclusive opinions about anything or about people that they don't know. So for me, it's like, it's not very inspiring, you know? So, of course, that's a general first thing that will be for me the most important part of my answer. Although I'm not saying anything in one sense about what you asked me about. But but also I will say in a more general way, and here I'm not pointing to your particular situation because I don't know it, but in Shastra they say, Tadivatabhat karmani kurbitana nirvidyeta javata shradavansa jayates juman sam... Matkato Shravanado Asrada Javana Jayate. proportionate to how much faith one has developed in the efficacy of bhakti, one doesn't need to engage in any other thing apart from that. But the implication is proportionate to the level that I have not developed pure, ultimate, exclusive faith, which is not something so cheap. One may need to engage in, as you will call in your case, naimittika dharma. No? So one that we never translated, I don't know if everyone knows what does it mean, naimittika dharma. Also, I don't know if you understand the word demon. Because sometimes we may use it, but everyone may have their own like notion of that. No? And I personally, again, as you may start to get to know me in this few days, last day, I don't like black and white definitions of things. So if I say a demon, my next question is how much of a demon I am. No, because for me, it's not like the demons are there and I'm the saintly guy here. No, I would like to be a saint, to be honest, but that doesn't mean there is asuric elements in me yet. So I like to always be strict with myself in that sense, no? Because it's easy to fall into a narrative of this like Kuru's Pandavas dichotomy, if you will. And the demons are out there and here we are. And I'm not telling this to you, I'm speaking in general because I don't know the details, but I've seen many times a subtle way of playing the victim again in this language of dichotomy, the karmis, the Buddhists, demons, saintly people, like if there are no any varieties in between those two, no shades of grey in between black and white. So of course I understand that there are some devotees who may, and again I'm speaking in general, please don't take that personal because we don't know each other that much indeed. although I'm willing to do so and I'm happy to be here and getting to know you more and more, but it takes time. Any relationship takes time. To know a person takes time and takes living together and so many things. So some devotees may have certain need to engage more actively in certain social dynamics or world dynamics in the context of social justice, or I mean there are so many departments as due to particular nature or some scars, some will be more identified one thing or the other, like to, they cannot avoid that because it's, I mean, they have to do it. They feel like, I have to do it. It's your nature. Krishna says you cannot change your nature almost. It's very difficult. So you try to dovetail your nature in the service of Krishna. So somehow, like for this example, and I would like to trust that that's your intention. I feel inclined towards researching on this on some level, although, as you say, it's not that I'm fully enjoying that, but there is something that calls me to set things straight, if you will. And I'll try to share that with my devotee friends in the spirit of Vaishnav Seva. There is place for that. You can do some research, you share with your friends. But of course, again, it's a very subtle thing from which place I'm sharing that, how much I'm exposing something or imposing something, how much I'm attached to having the other people reacting in a certain way. I'm not saying about you, I'm just saying things that happen in any situation that sometimes we not may. So the way to prove this is basically to be introspective ourselves and to analyze how much of these things may be there, or to expose ourselves to someone who really knows us from tip to toe and present the case and see how much it's really something that is motivated by pure universal compassion or something close to that, or by some the force of some egotistic force of wanting to be right or wanting other people to just hear me and tell me I'm right, or things in between these two also. Again, there's not black and white. So that will be my answer. So again, it's not specifically accurate to the specific, because the question was totally specific. Your case, yeah. What you did, yeah. Your motivation, and I really appreciate that you are opening that and sharing that with me. I mean, I'm trying to honor that somehow, but also part of my trying to honor that is to be honest and say, Sri Bhanga Prabhu, I don't know you that much, so I prefer to be cautious and not just speak too much, because I already speak too much. So I have to know also when not to speak in certain situations. No, it's, because you can enter into this idea of I'll tell people what to do in every situation and give opinions about everything. And no, sometimes I need to say, I don't know. Or I don't know you, or I don't know the topic, or let me think about that, let me do my research. It's not that one has absolute answers immediately here, no? So in this case, I will choose caution and of course trust your intentions, and with that invite you to your own introspection that hopefully it has already been going on, and hopefully that was the reason behind your research. That's the ideal.
That's the reason why I asked the question, because I'm in the process of still questioning.
So I appreciate that. I appreciate that you are willing to question your own actions, if you will. No, that's for me the most important thing, even. No, the willingness to say, Maharaj, I'm doing this, I did that, what do you think? No? Instead of, nobody can tell me anything, like the three monkeys, I'm right, and better you follow me, because if not, you are a demon.
Yeah, right.
So, of course, I'm not feeling that from you, so that gives me relief and sense of, okay, he's doing the thing from an introspective place, want to be cautious, want to do things right. And even if you did something wrong, let's say, if you are sincerely open to learn and change, so no problem. Krishna will make the arrangement for you to know that mistake, and you will be open to improve. Because for sure we are making, Krishna says in the Gita, each action is accompanied by so many imperfections. But if the important thing is not to be perfect always, but to be willing to acknowledge those things and keep growing. So that will be my significant contribution in this case.
I find it very helpful.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing that. So we are already 2 hours, and it's nice, and the camera is all black here, so nobody can see me. So I think we can put the session to rest here and continue tomorrow. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Sri Gaur Gadadhar ki jai, Sri Radha Govinda ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda ki jai.